Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is Plush Care. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week is Mark Knowles. Mark, you know, is a doubles player who won more than 700 matches on the ATP Tour over more than 20 years of playing the circuit. He is a coach. He's now a new board rep on the player side representing the Americas. But we are going to talk a lot this week about his work in the Bahamas during the U.S. Open. A few weeks ago, Hurricane Dorian ran through his island, and now Mark is helping in some of the rebuilding efforts. The Bahamar Cup is going on this week that Mark is hosting. Andy Roddick, James Blake, Coco Gauff, among those in attendance. So we talk a bit about his unlikely tennis backstory in the Bahamas, talk a bit about coaching, his new role on the ATP board. Good conversation with one of the good guys of tennis. Here's Mark Knowles. Where are you?
I just flew to the Bahamas yesterday. I have my big fundraiser starting on Friday.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. Big weekend for you.
Yeah, big weekend. Exciting.
How are things on the ground?
Nassau, you can't tell. I mean, obviously, Nassau wasn't affected. Unfortunately, you know, Northern Bahamas, Abaco, Freeport, not much has changed. I mean, it's been a lot of work, but it's just going to take a long time.
How personally did you feel this destruction?
Pretty personally, because my sister actually lived in Abaco. So unfortunately, she lost her entire business, got completely wiped out because the island that she operated her business on, I think of the 400 structures there were probably 8 standing.
Oh, man.
I mean, the island got completely wiped out. And also my stepfather had a hotel on that same island that got completely destroyed. So, you know, the good news is everybody was safe. But yeah, there was some devastation for sure.
I was thinking that. I remember that coincided with the U.S. Open.
Yeah, exactly.
So were you experiencing that from New York?
Yeah, that was tough. You know, it was weird being up there doing TV at the U.S. Open. And, you know, you're obviously connected to everybody back home. And it's kind of a helpless feeling because you know what's going on, but you can't really help. And, that was really a tough time. I think it's the same for everybody when tragedy's happening, either in the area where you're from or to people that you care about. You know, you want to be as close as possible to see if you can help. Obviously, there's not much you can do, but you just feel a little bit disconnected.
You're doing a lot this weekend. This is
we'll
put a link on the show page to the Bob Markup. How do these things? I'm sort of curious. I mean, you talk a little bit about the goals and the objectives, but I'm curious how these things come about. I mean, do you sort of start working your contacts and trying to set this up? Does this? I'm curious how these sort of form and formulate the events like this.
Yeah, it's interesting how this one actually came about, because Bahamar had approached me over the summer because they're big in giving back to community, and they have a Bahamar Foundation which gives back to, you know, the local communities, being the people of the Bahamas. And So they had approached me earlier in the summer about doing an event. And then unfortunately, you know, Hurricane Dorian hit and then everything shifted to, you know, we're going to go 100% of the proceeds directly to Hurricane Dorian relief. And, you know, it kind of a no-brainer, obviously. We just kind of, this was like, okay, this will be our launch. This will be our event. They have a great tennis club here at Baja Mar, so they're really big into tennis. So it was a nice fit right from the start. They wanted to have a tennis-centered event. And so obviously, you know, as you know, one thing about the tennis community, it's such a close-knit group of people. You know, obviously being up in New York during this tough time, obviously I heard from everybody. You know, most people associate the Bahamas with myself, and you know, it's amazing how many people reach out, how many people care. And you know, I've experienced it throughout my entire career, kind of the philanthropic kind of motivation that a lot of players have. You know, obviously started with Andre Agassi, and then Roddick had his own foundation. I had my own foundation. You know, the list goes on. There's a lot of guys that give back. And, you know, it's the same. Once everything hit, I remember Andy Roddick texted me right away. He goes, "You let me know what I can do. I'll be there in a second." And, you know, once this event came together, he's like, "I'll be there." You know, so it's great things like that that kind of makes you proud to have been a tennis player and to be part of this community, because, you know, you compete against each other for so long. It's such an individualized world. You know, and you have to be fairly selfish out there for a long time. But at the end of the day, there's such a strong respect amongst tennis players, and especially when they're hard times, tennis players come together to support any initiative.
I mean, I'll tell you something else that strikes me. You mentioned Andy and Andre, and I know James is going. But you also, this lesson seems to be ingrained pretty early. There's a 15-year-old who has quite a bit of celebrity heat right now, who I see is on the list as well. How did this come about with Coco Gauff?
Yeah, I mean, that's exciting. It's almost like the stars kind of aligned when we had secured Coco Gauff. There's also a gentleman named Steve Webster who's helping us getting some people, and he had spoken to Coco's management team. I had spoken to Tony Godsick, and you know, they were thrilled right away. And I remember actually, you know, I used to have my own foundation events for 13 straight years. And, you know, it's a good time to get those young superstars. I remember I used to have Nicole Vadiasova, to name a few, where, you know, they can't play a lot of tennis. They want to kind of get exposed and be out there and do fun things. And, you know, I have not gotten to meet Coco Gauff personally yet, but every single person that's met her, you know, speaks volumes. She's such an incredible person, and hard to believe that she's 15 years old. So, you know, it was really exciting because once she committed, I think she won her first tour event the very next week, coming through as a lucky loser.
Done,
so that worked out really well. And, you know, we're as thrilled as we are to have such an amazing lineup. We're even more thrilled to have Coco Gauff, you know, obviously who's kind of the next sensation in tennis.
That is a good get. But no, I think to your point, that's a great sign that a 15-year-old in a very busy offseason, I suspect, is doing something philanthropic like this and also something tennis-related like this.
Yeah, it's very special. You know, I mean, obviously, like you said, when you're that young, you're focused a lot on tennis and whatever, but she obviously has the right people around her. And it's important to try to be as well-rounded as possible as a tennis player, as you know. It can get very insulated and also isolated, so it's nice to be able to kind of spread your wings a little bit. So we're thrilled to have Coco Gauff.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You know, so someone wrote me
You know, I do this sort of mailbag, and I get all sorts of wacky questions. And someone asked me, and I don't know, I think I answered it. If Mark Knowles was related to, I think it's an Olympic sailor from the Bahamas.
Yes, Sir Durwood Knowles.
The broader question is just I don't know much about it. Tell us about your backstory and sort of what your folks did, and you were born and raised in the Bahamas.
My mom is British originally, and she was a tennis player. Actually, she played at Wimbledon. And my dad's from the Bahamas originally. So my mom was on vacation, kind of cruising. She was on her way to San Francisco, stopped in the Bahamas, and that was the end of that story. She met my dad and obviously fell in love with the weather and the people here in the Bahamas. And, you know, myself, along with my brother and my sister, were the fortunate ones. We were born in the Bahamas. We got to grow up here. Beautiful place. So I was exposed to tennis from a very young age because my parents taught tennis at a local tennis club. And, you know, I was one of those kids. I just fell in love with tennis. I think I started playing when I was 3 years old. I used to just go down, you know, there's long stories about how there was this little blonde kid that would just go down to the last court where there was a hitting wall. And I literally would hit there all day. They didn't have to worry where I was. And, as you know, the wall never misses. So those were some long rallies. That's how it started for me. I fell in love with the game of tennis from a young age. Was never forced. My parents, I was just around it. I was exposed to it. They did a great job back in the 70s, aging myself a little bit here. But, you know, they did a great job. They had a huge... A lot of kids played tennis. They had some great junior programs. So it was kind of the thing to do back in the 70s. So, you know, it was fun for me because I was also with my friends a lot, and you don't feel like you're really working or dedicating yourself to a certain sport. You're having a lot of fun while doing some sports. And, you know, from there, I was fortunate. I was playing the Orange Bowl, I believe, when I was 9 years old over in Florida. And the great Nick Bollettieri saw me playing over there. I thought I was a very talented kid, and he offered me a full scholarship to attend the Nick Bollettieri Tennis Academy. And, I went there the following year when I was 10 years of age. So obviously that's where my tennis really took off. I was one of the first guys to get there, but then obviously Jim Courier joined me there, Andre Agassi, the list goes on. And, it was such a great environment, for your tennis. And that's really where my tennis took off.
Were there any questions about relocating somewhere other than the Bahamas when you were done playing, or was this always the ambition?
Yeah, you know, Bahamas is always going to be home for me. We spent some time in Dallas as well with my wife and our kids. But we love it here. This is where my family's still here. My mom and dad, my brother and sister. This is home, and I think it'll always be home. We love it here. We're fortunate to get to travel and to go other places. So, we consider ourselves very fortunate.
So wait, the Olympic the Olympic sailor was family.
So no, he wasn't actually. A common little fact that people don't realize, and when you visit the Bahamas, it's funny. The Knowles is probably the most common last name. So when you go around the Bahamas, you see the name Knowles everywhere. So it's really funny because I remember when I was in school at UCLA, some of my friends came to Bahamas and like, you must be the richest guy in the world. Like your name is everywhere there. I'm like, no, unfortunately that's not my name. So it's just a very common name. Obviously I knew Sir Durwood very well. He's, you know, one of the first athletes to secure Olympic medal. He's a legend over here. But no direct relation.
I did. You're like the Parks of South Korea. Let me ask you, it's November, whatever it is, November 16th, thanks, Jamie. Middle of November, and what do we always hear? It's the season's winding down, and people are players are getting tired, and we're sort of playing out the string here. What is it really like at this stage in the year? I mean, is it a physical fatigue? Is it the last 5 miles of the marathon? Is it emotional? Is it spiritual? What is this period of the year really like for players? As often as we hear, everyone's tired.
I think there's a combination of mental and physical, but I think by far it's mental fatigue. And it's interesting. I read one of your mailbags recently about this actual discussion. And it's so true when you see guys still playing exhibitions or, you know, some type of promotional events. It's different, right? You're so relaxed. It's not competitive. You don't have to be ready the next day to play again. I think the grind of the full year, of the mental focus that it takes to know that you always have to bring your best day in, day out, it just wears you down. You know, when you get to the end of the year, you are so excited to just kind of put your feet up and not have to feel that kind of emotional stress. So I would say mostly it's mental fatigue. Obviously the body's broken down, but you know, most players can get through that. Most players know how to deal with, you know, lingering injuries and so forth, but it's the mental fatigue by the end of the year where players are just, you know, they're just beat up pretty badly. So I think that's the important thing. And, you know, you always hear about trying to shorten the season, and, you know, then you hear the other side, well, they're playing exhibitions. I don't understand. But, you know, exhibitions are so much lighter on not just the body, but the mind, more importantly. So, you know, I think it'll always be a constant struggle to try to find the right perfect amount of weeks for the year. It's tough because we have a long season. And it's just natural because, you know, these guys are getting better and better, right? So there's no easy matches anymore. You've got to be fully focused. Right. And I just think it takes its kind of emotional toll by the end of the year.
What is it about exhibitions that make them so different from conventional?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, you take away the stress, right? I mean, it doesn't really matter winning or losing. It doesn't really matter how you play per se. You're relaxed, you know. Everybody's a great player, so when they're relaxed, they're going to play great tennis probably regardless. So, you know, that's going to be taken care of. You know, there's some smiling. It's a much different emotional temperature compared to the week-in, week-out grind of the tour. So, you know, I think it's refreshing. I think it's a nice change of pace for a lot of players.
This was a busy fall for you, apart from organizing a fundraising event. You are the... I guess your term probably starts January 1st, I assume. But you're the new America's board rep on the ATP board, the new player rep.
Yeah, I'm excited. My term starts next year, but obviously I'm going to kick into high gear next week. I'm going to go over to London, participate in all the meetings, and, you know, just try to hit the ground running. I think it's a pivotal time, especially on the men's game. Obviously, you know, there's a lot of transition. You know, now that we have a chairman and looking for a CEO, we've kind of divided those duties, whereas it was combined before. You know, that's quite pivotal, trying to secure the next CEO. You know, and also I think, you know, I have a 3-year term. So over the next couple of years, there's going to be a huge transition. You know, when we talk about the big three, the three greatest of all time, you know, how long are they going to play? How do we set the game up for when they're not out there, you know, displaying their greatness for us? You know, so there are a lot of things, and I look forward to the challenge. Obviously, I've been around the game a very long time. Feel like I have a lot of knowledge that I can kind of lend, and, you know, I'm excited for the challenge. I think it's going to be a challenging role, but it's one that I really think that I can give my best at.
Wait, give us some highlights from the campaign speech. I mean, I think you're absolutely right, and for a variety of reasons, these next 3 years are going to be very interesting. We all love the big three, but, you know, their combined age, I think, exceeds 100 now. So, what's on the agenda? What do you see?
I think what I've seen kind of being around the inner side over the last 6 to 7 months or so, obviously it was very fractured, a lot of different agendas. And, you know, when I was playing on tour, I was the vice president of the player council for 2 terms. So, you know, I know what it's like on the inside there, and I know what's important. You know, you've got to be on the same page. Communication's got to be important right from the top all the way down to the players. And that responsibility lies obviously with the player council, but especially with the player board, just to make sure that there's, you know, the communication is very clear. I think we have to be, I think in seeing what the problems were over the last 6-8 months, you know, it was so fractured. It was not a united front at all coming from the player council, from the player board. And I think we need to get back to that, right? We can agree to disagree. That's always going to happen. That's part of life. We all come from different cultures. We all have different views. But once you leave the boardroom, you leave with the same message, regardless of, you know, whether you agreed with the opinion or disagreed with it. You know, I spent a long time on the Save the Doubles campaign. I was kind of the lead guy when they wanted to eliminate doubles. So, you know, I know what it's like. You've got to go in. You got to fight the battles. You know, you have tough conversations, whether it be with tournament directors, whether it be with your fellow players. You know, it's important to be, I think it's important to be very honest, very upfront. Try to make sure you're not having your kind of your own personal agendas. We're thinking for the betterment of the game, the long-term benefit of the game. That's important. It's not easy to do. Like I said, you're talking about a mindset as a tennis player where you have to be extremely selfish, because that's the way it is. You're playing against your opponent. Your opponent wants what you have. You want what your opponent wants to take from you. So, you know, you have this mentality, but yet all of a sudden when you're on the council or you're on the board, that becomes secondary. You have to kind of push that to the side. It's for the betterment of all, which is, you know, that's not your mindset as a tennis player. So, you know, that's a challenge. And, you know, I think education is big. I think a lot of times the players don't have the full story when, you know, when they maybe hit the social media platforms and then it creates a negative buzz. And that falls upon, starts probably with the player board relaying to the player council and then them relaying to the players to make sure that, you know, whatever their grievances are, they're fully informed. So they come up with an educated opinion rather than, so many times I see it's really just a quarter or half of the story, not understanding the full ramifications of the story or why this decision was made. So, you know, to make a long story short, I think, obviously, as I said, I think communication and making sure that we're as clairvoyant as possible with the players is going to be very important. And I think at the end of the day, you have to realize that, you know, because of the structure of the ATP with three player board reps, three tournament board reps, sure, of course, they're not always going to see eye to eye. Majority of the time, they're not. But we're all working for the same thing, for our sport to be greater. So we've got to figure out that balance, which I think is very important.
Does the player board reps, do you have a position on this Toronto law firm that a number of players have engaged?
You know, like I said, unfortunately, I'm just kind of coming into it. So I'll be a lot more educated, especially next week being there. That's kind of why I'm going to London to be there for 5 days for all the meetings, to really kind of be up to speed on all the issues. I'm really not informed very well on that issue, so I probably couldn't speak to it right now.
We'll check back with you. But this is a three-year term that starts. I mean, this is the seat that Justin Gimelstam had occupied, and then Weller Evans. This is the America's seat.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
This was a 3-year term.
Yeah.
All right. Let me. I'll ask you. You. We'll do speed round. You are. Your event is the Bahamar Cup.
Yep.
November 7th to 10th. But I wanted to ask, how many cups. Cups are very popular in tennis right now.
Yeah,
how many cups can this sport sustain?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. I mean, it's going to be, this is a really interesting couple of months coming up with, you know, Davis Cup, obviously the new format. I'm very curious just to see how it all goes down. And then obviously just a month later, the ATP Cup. You know, I mean, I think, like I said, I'm going to have to become a lot more educated on all these issues, but, you know, I think right at the onset, it's going to be hard for both of those two events to survive independently. I think there's going to have to be, you know, we're going to have to look at some solutions. Obviously, the Laver Cup has done exceptionally well. They have terrific dates. You know, I think that's looked very positive. But, you know, as you mentioned, I think there's got to be a balance. Obviously, I think that you're seeing the different type of format. You know, the tough thing about tennis is such a traditional sport, as you know so well, John. It's tough to change traditional sports, right? And, you know, whether it's from scoring, you know, I remember changing the scoring in doubles, and, you know, it was like crazy to play a match tiebreak to decide a set. And, you know, but basically at the end of the day, you know, over time comes change. And, you know, I think we're seeing with the success of Laver Cup, people enjoy these special events, kind of a different format. You know, it'll be interesting, this, like I said, this condensed format for the Davis Cup. Obviously, complaints right from the start about not having home ties, you know, all the apparent things that are going to be different. Right. But it's going to be a unique setting. And, you know, let's see how it works, the shortened format and these types of things. You know, I think it's important to see how it plays out. And then we'll have the ATP Cup, like I said, just on its heels about a month later. So it's going to be interesting because it's going to be hard, obviously, for the top players to play both in that shorter period, especially when you talk about kind of bookending the off season. Right. So, you know, there's going to be things, but I think there is, you know, room for these types of events, obviously not too many, because then you take away from the tour, but I think there's a competitive balance there that hopefully we can find.
You're entirely too moderate and rational. What are you still? What does this do to your coaching obligations or duties?
Yeah, I mean, I obviously part of the reason I applied for the board position was I want to take a break from coaching. I really enjoy coaching. You know, the toughest part about coaching, obviously, is the travel. That's not something right. I'm that interested in. And, you know, it's unique situations where it can work. And I had some nice situations where, you know, with Milos, I only had to commit a certain amount of weeks and it worked perfectly with television. And same with Jack. You know, unfortunately, Jack got injured and that got shortened. But, you know, it's just something I wanted to kind of put on the back burner for a while. I'm not necessarily interested in coaching.
What you mentioned Jack. What does he have to do to get back? I mean, where is this train right now?
Yeah, I mean, that's a very interesting question. I haven't spoken to him in a long time. You know, I don't think we've ever seen anything like it, really. It's hard to see for me personally because, you know, having worked with him a little bit, having known him, you know, I played against him as a player as well. But, you know, having worked with him, and I have tremendous respect for the amount of ability he has. He can be a tremendous player, as we've seen in the past. He's got the skill set that, you know, should have him, you know, close to amongst the top players in the world. But unfortunately, you know, he's far from that right now. And he's going to have, you know, he's going to have some tough choices to make. Obviously, he's dropped really far down in the singles. He's still got, you know, still arguably the greatest doubles player out there right now. He plays, you know, an exceptional game of doubles, but having known him, I know that's not something he wanted to be necessarily. He didn't want to necessarily be just a doubles guy this early in his career. So, right. You know, but because of where his singles is, he's going to have some tough choices. You know, I just hope for his case, I just hope he gives himself a legitimate chance to come back and see where his ability is, because I think he has a lot of ability. And, you know, I think one thing that's important, and you know this, John, you cover the sport a lot, is that, you know, we get so caught up in how somebody hits forehands or backhands. But, you know, Jack's probably a good story amongst many others where there's just so much more that goes into the game of tennis when you talk about computing and figuring out how successful they're going to be. And, you know, it's not that easy, right? And that's probably what speaks even more volumes for the big three. Not just how great that's they play, but how yeah, they've been yeah. able to sustain their motivation, their professionalism. And that's why, in my opinion, we will never see three players like this ever again. We may see three players of the same generation that play equally as well, but they will never have the combination of skill, professionalism, motivation that these guys have shown. It's just remarkable, because it's not that easy, right? And for those people that don't necessarily know tennis and are looking from the outside, they're like, oh, these three guys just dominate everything, you know, right, it's so right. easy. But, you know, they make it look easy, but they know it's not easy because they work extremely hard. They make the right decisions. You know, it goes down to even with Roger pulling out of Paris Masters, right? He continues to make the right decisions for his body. Same with Rafa. You know, they pull out at difficult moments, but they're thinking long term, and, you know, their body of work will never be matched.
No, I think that's a really good point. That we have a lot of indications of how fragile this can be, and it's yeah. Andy Murray's hip. But you know, I mean, Jack Sock does not have a ranking, and it's Del Potro. When these guys are consistently in the top three over 15 years, that says as much to me as the Grand Slam tally. This was great. I would say I got to point this out. I think the one and only time I was in the Bahamas, I got off the plane, and the first thing I saw was a photo of you on the wall outside my gate. So you may travel nice. A lot, but at least you get to see the Mark Knowles Hall of Fame wall when you walk to pick up your bag. But that gives some indication of your profile in the Bahamas as well.
Yeah, it's still an honor for me. It's obviously very cool, especially with my kids. You know, every time we come back home, they stop and kind of look at it. They'll take occasional pictures. So, you know, it's obviously a lot of fun. And It's been an honor to represent the Bahamas. Obviously, we're a very small country, and you know, we've achieved a lot on the athletic scene, and a lot of that has come through me and tennis. And you know, I've been proud to represent this great country.
You're one of the many Knowles of the Bahamas, the one and only Mark Knowles. This is great. We'll put a link to the event this weekend. And if there, awesome. I don't know if there's a silent auction, or if there are other ways for people to contribute, even if they're not on site. Let me know about that too.
Okay, I will. Perfect. Thanks, John. Thanks for
great.
Your time. I'm
right.
honored
Likewise.
To finally make it on, man.
Oh, come
Appreciate
on.
It.
Pleasure. Likewise. We'll see you down the road.
All right, buddy. All,
right,
all the best, man. All right,
you
take
too.
Care.
All right. Thanks to Mark for stopping by, spending some time. Thanks, as always, to Jamie for her sorcery producing. Jamie, I have a question for you. Did you ever read the David Foster Wallace essay, great piece of tennis writing, String Theory?
I think you made me read it back in the day.
I made you read that?
I think so.
Oh, good. I'm glad I did that. I don't recall that, but I'm glad I did. No, that was my first. I bring that up because that I think may have been when Mark Knowles first crossed my radar. He has one of the great quotes of that story, and a quote that I use all the time. I don't know if you remember that. He was qualifying for the event in Montreal, and they were still hammering bleachers together and testing out the PA system, and he said, you know, it's all right. We're just playing tennis for money here. Don't mind us. We're just professional athletes trying to compete on a tour. I always remember that early in sporting events when people are actually playing and other people aren't courteous. Anyway, that was my I think that's when Mark Knowles may have first crossed my radar. But he had a absolutely tremendous career and one of the good people. I feel like I say that a lot. The sport, for all of its flaws, really has a vast cohort of good men and women, but Mark is certainly among them. I liked what he said, too. I don't know if that struck you about tennis obviously has this gladiatorial? Check that. You know, tennis has this one-on-one nature, and you know, there's only one winner at the end, and everyone's sort of competing with each other, but there also is a sense of community, and we see that a lot in these cases of philanthropy. Fall is sort of the season for philanthropy, too, in this sport.
Yeah, I kind of like what he said about, you know, that you spend your whole career very sticking to yourself, and it's a very individualized thing. We talk about that a lot as in tennis as compared to team sports. So it's nice to, as you say, hear people come together for good causes, but then just generally have people, you know, throw aside competition sometimes and just sort of use the team spirit to boost their personal game, boost the sport, everything. So
yeah, I think that also dovetails with what he was saying about the ATP Tour. And look, there are interests that aren't always aligned, especially between players and tournaments, but among players, you know, everybody wants the biggest check and the trophy at the end of the week. But there also, that has to coexist with this idea that you are trying to grow the enterprise here. And you may be on the other side of the net from me, and you and I may differ on how to split revenues that come in, but we're all going to benefit if the cliche alert, if the pie gets bigger, if the rising, what is it? The rising tide lifts the boats, whatever the cliche is. But it's an interesting sort of individual collective dynamic in this sport.
I also, you wrote about, or was asked, you were asked about exhibitions and, you know, the how many there are nowadays and how sort of that impacts players. And I thought Mark's answer was really smart about mental health. I mm-hmm. think it's something mm-hmm. we kind of forget, but if you're able to just be in your workplace but kind of just hang out, maybe it relieves a little bit of stress. And I think that's an important thing we probably don't remember, is that it may not always be, like, I like what he said about these are all great players, so if they turn it off a little bit, they're still going to be good tennis and they're still going to get something out of it. So
yeah, that was this question about how do these players all bitch about how long the season is, and then as soon as the season's over they go and play exhibitions. Isn't that inconsistent? Isn't that hypocritical? And I think Mark's point was really good. I mean, first of all, that just physically you can go at 80% in exhibitions and nobody's losing sleep over a loss, but I think the mental side, it's really stressful to play in a tournament and they're ball kids and their ranking points on the line, and you don't know when your next match is, and oh, I play Lasanti in the next round, but she's got to beat the other guy, I'm going to keep an eye on that match. Mm-hmm. Their uncertain starting times, I've got to find out if my hotel does laundry, and if I win I've got to rebook my ticket. I mean, exhibitions have none of that, so right. It's none of the physical stress, but also you know when you're going to play, you know who your opponent is, you don't have to worry that the ranking points are going to come off. Can I make a segue, as long as we are both talking about ranking points?
Sure.
So when Mark was talking, I wanted to see if there had been any sort of formal announcement about whether he's still working with Jack Sock. Jack Sock, ranking, N/A.
Does not exist.
Jack Sock does not have an ATP singles ranking right now.
It's crazy.
I've never, I mean, so 2 years ago, just to level set, almost 2 years ago to the day.
Yeah, really. I was going to say. To the week, whatever.
So
Mid-November.
Mid-November 2017, Jack Sock is a top 10 player.
And I mean, we're talking like, we talked about this last week, but fall season, you know, he's going to take a month off, come back in January. Wow, what a great 2018 right. Jack Sock can have. He can ride this wave.
I've never seen anything like, I mean, I think Mark said the same thing. I mean, we've seen players slip and their injuries. And, you know, Andre Agassi famously was outside the top 100 before he had that comeback. This is a whole different level.
I think we should caveat that he did have a very good 2018 in doubles.
Yes.
So I think aside, you know, he didn't fall off the face of the earth and you know, become no longer good at tennis overall. I mean, it's his singles ranking doesn't exist. I mean, his doubles ranking is 121, which isn't great, but at least it's a number.
Right. And I think that's probably just a function of his not playing all that many events.
Right. But I mean, if you look at his, it's remarkable trying to figure out where the drop off is. And honestly, there's really no point where you're like, oh, maybe that loss did it. It just seemed like he lost in the first round at the Australian Open. And then as the weeks went on, it just was first round loss after first round loss. And then after that, he started playing in some challengers. And then was losing in the challengers.
Yeah, I'm looking here. He's retired from his last two challengers. In Las Vegas, he lost to Mikhail Pervolarakis, $449.
$500
in $520, yeah. And then the next round. You know, I'll tell you a funny story as an aside. He lost to Sekou Bangura in Charlottesville about 10, maybe even 12 years ago, 15 years ago. Somebody tipped me off to Sekou Bangura as a junior player who's living in Bradenton, and I spent a day with him for a Sports Illustrated story, who was just a great, lovely kid. Mm-hmm. He had a state ranking in the conceit of the story was he had a state ranking in tennis, golf, and chess.
Wow.
It was a great sort of one of these one-page offbeat stories. Nice to see he chose tennis. I believe he played at the University of Florida, and now he's ranked 336 is Sekou Bangura. Oh, my God, I'm dating myself. So he's 27 years old. So, yeah, this must have been about 10, 12 years ago. He was a great kid. Glad to see sticking with tennis. I'm sure he has a bright future beyond the sport. But Sekou Bangura can now say he beat a former top 10 player, Jack Sock, and that just happened a few weeks ago in Charlottesville. All right. Anything else on your mind tennis-wise? Where the women's season is kind of sort of over, except I was at speaking of tennis and philanthropy. There was a luncheon to raise funds for the NYJTL yesterday, and a number of players and figures in tennis were there. And we think the women's season is over, but there is an event in Houston that has attracted a number of players. One of them, Cece Bellis. Nice to see her making a return.
Back from injury.
Another former podcast guest, Danielle Collins, will be in the field. Carolyn Wozniacki is at Harvard Business School with as well as Bethany Maddox Sands. Fall's an interesting time in this sport. Everyone kind of goes their own way. But if you thought the women's tennis season was over, keep an eye on this Houston event because there's some interesting storylines and some fine players in the field. And then obviously still a big men's event.
Yeah. So we'll have a little break. We'll have our Tuesday off season. But for now, we've got a little bit more to gobble up. But I actually enjoy seeing how different players, as you're saying, spend the off season. I think it tells you a little bit about where they are in their careers, what their body is feeling like at that point in time. You know, for someone like Cece Bellis coming back, hasn't played, she's ready to get out there and play. She's not going to be taking time off this off season. So it's always interesting how that ebb and flow leaks into the Australian Open.
Right. No, and it also goes to what we were talking about earlier about just different players have different needs and different interests. And some players say, oh, the season is too long. There are too many events. There are too many obligations. And other players say there are not enough opportunities. I wish there were events every week. So you know, Danielle Collins, top, you know, this is a player gets seeded at majors. Here it is mid-November, and she'll be playing in Houston. So anyway, interesting sport. But it was good spending some time with Mark Knowles. We'll include a link to that. And you know what? While we're here, we will include the NYJTL link as well, because that was a great fundraising event for a great program. And I know there's some silent auction items that I suspect are still available for purchase if people want to make a contribution there. This was our philanthropy podcast.
I was
going
to say that.
You like that?
Took the words out of my mouth.
All right. That does it for this week. Thanks, Jamie. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Keep the guest suggestions coming. We'll do another one next week. Subscribe, leave a review, iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. And we'll do it again in 7 days. Have a good week, everyone.